A reference to a few of the provisions of the Constitution will illustrate this proposition. For example, no one, we presume, will contend that Congress can make any law in a territory respecting the establishment of religion, or the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or of the right of the people of the territory peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for the redress of grievances. Nor can Congress deny to the people the right to keep and bear arms, nor the right to trial by jury, nor compel anyone to be a witness against himself in a criminal proceeding. These powers and others in relation to the rights of person, which it is not necessary here to enumerate, are in express and positive terms denied to the general government. And the rights of private property have been guarded with equal care. Thus, the rights of property are united with the rights of person and placed on the same ground by the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, which provides that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, and property without due process of law. And an act of Congress which deprives a citizen of the United States of his liberty or property merely because he came himself or brought his property into a particular territory of the United States, and who had committed no offense against the laws, could hardly be dignified with the name of due process of law. So, too, it will hardly be contended that Congress could by law quarter a soldier in a house in a territory without the consent of the owner in time of peace, nor in time of war, but in a manner prescribed by law. Nor could they by law forfeit the property of a citizen in a territory who was convicted of treason for a longer period than the life of the person convicted, nor take private property for public use without just compensation. The powers over person and property of which we speak are not only not granted to Congress, but are in express terms denied, and they are forbidden to exercise them. And this prohibition is not confined to the states, but the words are general and extend to the whole territory over which the Constitution gives it power to legislate, including those portions of it remaining under territorial government, as well as that covered by the states. It is a total absence of power everywhere within the dominion of the United States and places the citizens of a territory, so far as these rights are concerned, on the same footing with citizens of the states, and guards them as firmly and plainly against any inroads which the general government might attempt under the plea of implied or incidental powers. And if Congress itself cannot do this, if it is beyond the powers conferred on the federal government, it will be admitted, we presume, that it could not authorize a territorial government to exercise them. It could confer no power on any local government established by its authority to violate the provisions of the Constitution. It seems, however, to be supposed that there is a difference between property in a slave and other property, and that different rules may be applied to it in expounding the Constitution of the United States. And the laws and usages of nations and the writings of eminent jurists upon the relation of master and slave and their mutual rights and duties and the powers which government may exercise over it have been dwelt upon in the argument. But in considering the question before us, it must be borne in mind that there is no law of nations standing between the people of the United States and their government and interfering with their relation to each other. The powers of the government and the rights of the citizen under it are positive and practical regulations plainly written down. The people of the United States have delegated to it certain enumerated powers and forbidden it to exercise others. It has no power over the person or property of a citizen but what the citizens of the United States have granted. And no laws or usages of other nations or reasoning of statesmen or jurists upon the relations of master and slave can enlarge the powers of the government or take from the citizens the rights they have reserved. And if the Constitution recognizes the right of property of a master and a slave, and makes no distinction between that description of property and other property owned by a citizen, no tribunal acting under the authority of the United States, whether it be legislative, executive, or judicial, has a right to draw such a distinction or to deny it the benefit of the provisions and guarantees which have been provided for the protection of private property against the encroachments of the government. Now, as we have already said in an earlier part of this opinion, upon a different point, the right of property in a slave is distinctly and expressly affirmed in the Constitution. The right to traffic in it, like an ordinary article of merchandise and property, was guaranteed to the citizens of the United States in every state that might desire it for 20 years. And the government, in express terms, is pledged to protect it in all future time if the slave escapes from his owner. This is done in plain words, too plain to be misunderstood. And no word can be found in the Constitution which gives Congress a greater power over slave property or which entitles property of that kind to less protection than property of any other description. The only power conferred is the power coupled with the duty of guarding and protecting the owner in his rights. Upon these considerations, it is the opinion of the Court that the act of Congress which prohibited a citizen from holding and owning property of this kind in the territory of the United States north of the line therein mentioned is not warranted by the Constitution and is therefore void, and that neither Dred Scott himself nor any of his family were made free by being carried into this territory, even if they had been carried there by the owner with the intention of becoming a permanent resident. We have so far examined the case as it stands under the Constitution of the United States and the powers thereby delegated to the federal government. But there is another point in the case which depends on state power and state law. And it is contended on the part of the plaintiff that he is made free by being taken to Rock Island in the state of Illinois, independently of his residence in the territory of the United States. And being so made free, he was not again reduced to a state of slavery by being brought back to Missouri. Our notice of this part of the case will be very brief, for the principle upon which it depends was decided in this court, upon much consideration, in the case of Strader et al. Versus Graham. In that case, the slaves had been taken from Kentucky to Ohio with the consent of the owner, and afterwards brought back to Kentucky. And this court held that their status or condition as free or slave depended upon the laws of Kentucky when they were brought back into that state, and not of Ohio, and that this court had no jurisdiction to revise the judgment of a state court upon its own laws. This was the point directly before the court, and the decision that this court had not jurisdiction turned upon it, as will be seen by the report of that case. So in this case, as Scott was a slave when taken into the state of Illinois by his owner and was there held as such and brought back in that character, his status as free or slave depended on the laws of Missouri and not of Illinois. It has, however, been urged in the argument that by the laws of Missouri he was free on his return and that this case, therefore, cannot be governed by the case of Strader et al. Versus Graham, where it appeared by the laws of Kentucky that the plaintiffs continued to be slaves on their return from Ohio. But whatever doubts or opinions may at one time have been entertained upon this subject, we are satisfied upon a careful examination of all the cases decided in the state courts of Missouri referred to, that it is now firmly settled by the decisions of the highest court in that state that Scott and his family upon their return were not free, but were by the laws of Missouri the property of the defendant, and that the Circuit Court of the United States had no jurisdiction when by the laws of the state the plaintiff was a slave and not a citizen. Moreover, the plaintiff, it appears, brought a similar action against the defendant in the state court of Missouri, claiming the freedom of himself and his family upon the same grounds and the same evidence upon which he relies in the case before the court. The case was carried before the Supreme Court of the state, was fully argued there, and that court decided that neither the plaintiff nor his family were entitled to freedom and were still the slaves of the defendant. And it reversed the judgment of the inferior state court, which had given a different decision. If the plaintiff supposed that this judgment of the Supreme Court of the state was erroneous, and that this court had jurisdiction to revise and reverse it, the only mode by which he could legally bring it before this court was by writ of error directed to the Supreme Court of the state, requiring it to transmit the record to this court. If this had been done, it is too plain for argument that the writ must have been dismissed for want of jurisdiction in this court. The case of Strader and others v. Graham is directly in point, and indeed independent of any decision, the language of the 25th section of the Act of 1789 is too clear and precise to admit of controversy. But the plaintiff did not pursue the mode prescribed by law for bringing the judgment of a state court before this court for revision but suffered the case to be remanded to the inferior state court where it still continued and is by agreement of the parties to await the judgment of this court on the point. All of this appears on the record before us and by the printed report of the case. And while the case is yet open and pending in the inferior state court, the plaintiff goes into the circuit court of the United States upon the same case and the same evidence and against the same party and proceeds to judgment, and then brings here the same case from the circuit court which the law would not have permitted him to bring directly from the state court. And if this court takes jurisdiction in this form, the result, so far as the rights of the respective parties are concerned, is in every respect substantially the same as if it had, in open violation of law, entertained jurisdiction over the judgment of the state court upon a writ of error and revised and reversed its judgment upon the ground that its opinion upon the question of law was erroneous. It would ill become this court to sanction such an attempt to evade the law or to exercise an appellate power in this circuitous way, which it is forbidden to exercise in the direct and regular and invariable forms of judicial proceedings. Upon the whole, therefore, it is the judgment of this court that it appears by the record before us that the plaintiff in error is not a citizen of Missouri in the sense in which that word is used in the Constitution, and that the Circuit Court of the United States for that reason had no jurisdiction in the case and could give no judgment in it. Its judgment for the defendant must consequently be reversed, and a mandate issued directing the suit to be dismissed for want of jurisdiction.